Be seated, please. Our last case of the morning is number 22-11776, Shiloh Christian Center versus Aspen Specialty Insurance Company. Mr. Struble. And you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Matthew Struble for the appellant appellant Shiloh Christian Center. The district court in this case committed reversible error by granting summary judgment as to all damages, not by relying on the insurance policy, but by relying solely on extrinsic evidence.
Is this sort of one of those crazy cases in which you've got the face of the policy on your side, and like every ounce of what we think we know about what really happened here is on the other side, and there's just this potential windfall in the offing?
I would say, and for other reasons. You look at the facts, and the insurance company knew from the beginning. We found out in discovery that it was ambiguous, but no, not at all. And in fact, if you look and we kind of detail, again, it's not relevant as the cases that this court even pointed out what the parties were thinking, what documents were going on. But if you want to consider that for a moment, just to answer your question, clearly you look at the affidavits, you look at when the claim was reported, the insured never even believed there was any possibility that interior water damage would be excluded. And so even if you improperly consider extrinsic evidence and improperly consider whether the insured should have known that there was exclusion for wind damage, there was never any possibility of knowledge that interior water damage would be excluded. So it is not the case for that reason.
But that was never the basis of your claim, right? You never made an interior water damage.
It was the primary basis for the claim. And if you go through the facts in our, it starts out in our initial brief, and I'll just quickly point you to just some of the pages, page 3-4 in our brief, you'll see that the claim was reported as interior damage to ceiling, walls, and floorings. So when the insured by the, herself, reported the claim, she didn't even report wind damage. She reported claims for interior water damage. And the policy quite...
Is it true, though, that in both years, the claim named the storm?
I'm sorry?
Your claims for both years, true, the 2016, or the claim on the 2016 policy refers to water damage, but it says water damage from Hurricane Matthew. And then the 2017 one says, you know, cause of loss, Hurricane Irma, right?
Correct, yes. And the difference I think you might be thinking of is on the policy, the 2016 to the 2017 policy, on the declaration page, it said $5,000 deductible for all losses, $25,000 for wind or hail, parentheses excluding named windstorm. And then you go on to read the policy itself. The policy clearly provides coverage, all risk coverage. Says only exclusions apply. There's no exclusions for wind. And it specifically says that if you have interior water damage and that interior water damage is caused by an opening in your roof or your walls from wind, then that is covered. So that's the first policy we're operating under. The
Doesn't
second
that
one.
That provision ties back to damage by a covered cause of loss, which would loop us right back to the named storm issue, wouldn't it?
No. If you look at our brief and we walk through the policy in the first few pages, it's. Page 4 of our initial brief cites the policy provision, and it provides special coverage, and then it loops you to what you're indicating, Your Honor, what is covered, and then also what is excluded. And what is covered, the starting point, is any damage is covered, and it's only possibly excluded if it's excluded under Section B exclusions. And under Section B exclusions, there's a number of them, none of which are wind, none of those which are a named windstorm. And in fact, that there's a potential exclusion for interior water damage, but that's actually covered if there was an opening created by wind. And that's why the importance, all these extrinsic facts that we're talking about, if you look at the cases that we were asked to be prepared for, they make it very clear that if there's a patent ambiguity, you can't look beyond the policy. And by all accounts, the ambiguity at the first policy, that's what it was, because on the declaration page, it referenced, in parentheses, it said named windstorm exclusion, but the policy itself clearly provided coverage for all damages, including wind and interior water. You go on to the second policy that was issued for Hurricane Irma, the 17th to 18th policy, And that policy made no indication whatsoever that a named windstorm would possibly be excluded, nor any exclusion whatsoever. So that
you do think that the policies were ambiguous with respect to named windstorms?
I was just going into that. So the first policy is ambiguous because, as we detailed, there's a parenthetical in the declarations page which says excluding named windstorm with no definition, no indications. That include interior water damage? So that one has a patent ambiguity, and obviously the district court found that because the court only relied on extrinsic evidence. The district court found no support in the policy to find its exclusion, solely relied on emails from an agent. As the IRMA policy, there's no ambiguity at all. Instead, the IRMA policy, as we argued, and this court, or your very smart clerks, found the case, you know, even better than I had found, because it really highlights that point, and that's the Emergency Associates of Tampa versus Sasano case. And in that case, that explained that if you look at just the terms of the policy itself, in that case, it was looking at, you just said the policy was, they were able to look at just the terms alone and see that there was coverage based on that provision. When you look at just the IRMA policy alone, which is the starting point, it clearly provides coverage not only for wind, not only for interior water damage, but also for a named windstorm, because on that policy, they removed that parenthetical, and that's undisputed as well.
With respect to the 2016 policy, where I guess you've acknowledged that you think there is an ambiguity on the face of the policy, what then? Like, what sort of, do the rules governing patent and or latent ambiguities govern, or does this canon of construing insurance policies in favor of the insured contra profferentum, if I'm pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, thank you. Yep, so two things to that. And if you look at the questions we're asked to prepare for in those cases, this circuit previously certified basically the exact question in Washington National versus Rudderman to the Florida Supreme Court, asking, and basically the question submitted was, the decisions that are out there that allow extrinsic evidence in an attempt to be considered to explain, does that apply in an insurance context? And the Florida Supreme Court clearly said no. In an insurance context, it's very different. In an insurance context, you never even get there, and you don't get there because it's automatically construed against the insurer. It's different than your typical contract. And the third question that was...
So let me ask you this just so I make sure I understand. Does that mean that the whole sort of like interpretive enterprise that might otherwise apply in the face of patent or latent ambiguity just like doesn't apply in the insurance context?
Yeah, there's...
You don't get there.
Yes, and that's the 11th Circuit submitted that question to the Florida Supreme Court, and that's exactly what the Florida Supreme Court said. It said that you don't get there. And then even highlighting in this case, the last question we were asked to prepare for was asked, we were asked about whether this policy has a integration clause, and that's the last question. And in this case, not only does Florida law make it very clear that the insurer is bound by the policy only, you can't rely on any other documents, the policy itself, which is cited on the January 23rd, 2023 order from this court, identified that the insurance policy drafted by Aspen included a provision entitled Changes, Common Policy Conditions, and clearly says that the policy contains all the agreements between you and us concerning the insurance afforded. The policy terms can be amended or waived only by an endorsement issued by us and made part of this policy. So in this case, as the question found, not only is Florida law, Florida Supreme Court clear on that issue, their very own insurance policy said the only way the terms of this policy can be changed is through a policy endorsement that's attached to the policy. In this case, they never issued an endorsement. They never issued an exclusion for a named windstorm, and they certainly never attached it to the policy. So looking at their very own provision, which is the integration provision, the merger provision, you look at the cases that this court cited in the January 23rd, 2023 order, and that makes very clear that when a contract has an integration clause like that, that is binding, and the parties are bound by the contract because it is presumed that the contract terms are the only terms that exist. That is the third reason why the district court could not possibly have found no coverage, because it was bound by the terms only, by the contract based on the Florida Supreme Court's decision, and based by the policy itself, which says you only go by this court. So the entire ruling of the district court was premised on looking outside the policy and looking at emails back and forth from an agent and the insurance company's agent, the insured's agent. That's the only basis the district court could come up with, or Aspen for that matter, to argue against coverage, and that was impermissible as a matter of law. So because of that, because contract interpretation was clearly not followed here, that's a legal error as a matter of law that requires reversal.
I just want to make sure I understand your argument. So you're saying that the at least one policy was ambiguous, right?
Yeah, so it's actually the Matthew policy, it's actually they're arguing essentially that it's ambiguous because they're saying that, well, if you look at the...
But what are you saying is what I'm asking?
Yeah, what I am saying is that the Hurricane Matthew policy clearly provided coverage for interior water damage. There's no exclusion for that at all. And that policy is ambiguous at best. So it's either certainly covered or ambiguous at best because the declaration page had one word in the parenthesis, named windstorm. And you look at the heart of the policy, there's no exclusion whatsoever, and it actually specifically provides coverage for interior water damage. That's the first policy. As to the second one, we're actually saying that the policy is clear, and nobody can dispute that because there's no indication or reference in any portion of the policy anywhere that the named wind and storm exclusion is ever excluded. And if you look at the record, look at our brief, we cite the details. The insurance company knew it. They acknowledged the ambiguity. They knew they made a mistake, and they just did nothing about it until...
I guess I don't understand. You just said it was clear, but then you said the insurance company acknowledged the ambiguity. So do you think it's clear or that there's an ambiguity?
So if I could, and I'm over time, if I could just get 30 seconds because it is an important point.
You're good. Your answer.
Okay. Thank you. So on the first policy, the Hurricane Matthew policy, our position is that the policy is clear that it provides coverage for interior water damage. Okay, that's our first position as to that. And secondly, to the extent they want to say other damages like exterior wind damage is excluded, that's ambiguous because there's one portion in the declarations page that makes a three-word reference to that.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you right there. So if for that portion which you say is ambiguous, does it matter whether that ambiguity is patent or latent in your view?
It absolutely does, and it's patent because it's identified on the face of the policy only, and because of that, it's proper to consider extrinsic evidence.
Okay, and do you think did the district court discuss the distinction between patent and latent ambiguity?
And the order did not go into any details of it. Clearly, obviously, it didn't say whether the policy was ambiguous or not. Presumably had to have because it said it's excluded without relying on the policy. Instead, it relied the court district court relied on emails, which was impermissible.
So I'm so sorry, but now I think I'm confused. So with respect to 2017, I get it, right? There's no weirdness in the declarations page. So you say 2017 is clear as a bell. 2016, you acknowledge at least potentially in backup, in the alternative, that it is at worst for you ambiguous. And then so I thought in response to me, you said, and the Florida Supreme Court on a certified question from the 11th Circuit has said, when an insurance policy is ambiguous, you just construe it in favor of the insured. But then in response to Judge Grant, she asks you whether it matters whether the ambiguity is latent or patent, and you say it absolutely matters. But I thought in response to my contra proferentum question, you had said all this latent patent stuff just doesn't apply in insurance policies, and you'd never get there.
Yeah, it doesn't apply for the second reason, so I can answer your question exactly. So as 2017, our position is clear. As 2016, our position is that there is an ambiguity. That ambiguity is patent, or patent, however you say that word. And because it is that means that you can't look at extrinsic evidence. So the district court reversed for that reason. And what you're referring to, Judge, is in that I also said, and then in addition to the court erring, committing error because it could not look at extrinsic evidence when there's a patent ambiguity, it also erred because beyond that, that's just general contract interpretation. Beyond that, when you're dealing with insurance policy interpretations, as the Florida Supreme Court case held, that's an even higher standard for a secondary reason you cannot do that, and it's construed in favor of the insured. So what I was saying was both of those are reasons why the district court erred.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Rumbley.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Charles Rumbley here on behalf of Aspen Specialty Insurance Company. So I don't think anybody in this room has any doubts about the actual facts behind this. It's fairly clear from the record that the plaintiffs did not purchase coverage for named windstorm. They saved themselves approximately $22,000 a year for a number of years by not getting the coverage. The evidence in the record, the communications between the agent and the insurance company, it was clearly no intent, factually, to purchase that type of coverage. We're here today to talk about whether or not, despite all of the actual interactions and dealings between the parties, they should be entitled to recover for these two hurricanes because of some error or ambiguity or what have you in the policies.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of sort of hand waving. I mean, like, I don't think they would say, I mean, the policy is what it is. It says what it says. Doesn't exclude for named windstorms. It's got an integration clause. I mean, maybe we should just do it policy by policy, but like, what do you have to say to 2017?
Well, so before I get to 2017, the history I think is important. And first of all, my client has not conceded that the policies were ambiguous. The corporate representatives did not concede it was ambiguous. So
you think the 2017 policy unambiguously excludes named windstorms? How?
All right. So the district court did not rely solely on this extrinsic evidence. The district court relied on Marcassano. It's the Florida Supreme Court case that we briefed. It says that when a policy renews year to year, it renews basically on its own terms and continues year to year. So we have the original policy that issued in 2014. That's the policy that did have coverage for windstorm.
Can I ask you a question about Marcassano? Is that how
yes.
pronouncing it? Marcassano, though, doesn't say that the parties are entitled to rely on the renewals. It says the insured is entitled to rely on the renewals.
Yes.
Which makes sense in light of contra profferentum, that the insured gets the benefit of every doubt, right?
So, yes. So that was a UM rejection case. And in that case, I know the language that you're talking about, Your Honor. The insurance company was saying in that case that we don't owe you the increased limits after the insured had selected, I think, $20,000 in limits versus $300,000, which was their liability limit. So the insurer was arguing, hey, we shouldn't be bound by these terms of the renewal policy because, you know, we didn't sign the UM rejection form for that year, you know, let us out of that. So while the court does say the insured is entitled to rely, I think another interpretation is the insured is entitled to expect that the terms of the policy that they have are going to be from the renewal. So by that same token, you know, Aspen is entitled, and the plaintiff is entitled to rely on the fact that they don't have windstorm coverage for that, for both of the hurricanes.
So is it your position then under that case that no matter how different, how materially, whatever the terms of the policy itself are, that this renewal sort of proposition sort of trumps? I mean, like, what if the renewal, what if the policy terms, the new policy, let's say the 2016 policy, what if that shows that the premium should be $1 million a month? Is the insured still, you know, sort of, is it okay if the insured just says, like, no, because this was a renewal and it was only $50 last year?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question in a hypothetical just based on premium increases. I can tell you in this case that the policy was the same forms. We had the same commercial property forms. You know, the only change was, from 2015 to 2016, there was no endorsement from 2015. If you look at, later on, you can look, appendix tab for the plaintiff 25-4 is that 2015 endorsement that came in and removed the named windstorm coverage. And it says in, it just, named windstorm coverage is removed from this policy. I don't think there's anything ambiguous about that. I think everybody knows what a named windstorm is.
Well, right, but the ambiguity attaches, it either attaches or it doesn't attach to the face of the policy, right? We're not asking about whether or not, sort of something that happened in 2015 is or is not ambiguous. We're here to litigate the 2016 and 2017 policy.
Yes, but based on Marcassano, we're still, you know, this is an operative policy endorsement to consider. The actual endorsement that came around in 2015 to remove that provision.
But what if what if other evidence showed that there was an intention to put back in that coverage, right? It's not like there, it's not like there's no way to do that.
Well, first of all, there was no intention to put that.
I get it. I'm just saying, yeah. You will not concede anything about your particular facts. But I'm saying in a different case, if there's an exclusion earlier and then the parties intend to get rid of that exclusion, there has to be a way to do that, right? Sure. You would do that on the face of the new policy, wouldn't you?
Sure. And if it doesn't appear on the face, then you might have a latent defect that we would go into the extrinsic evidence. But I'm glad you brought up the point of intent, because there is an exception to this latent patent defect issue and extrinsic evidence that was brought up in the order you presented to us. While I was doing my research on this, I found a case that came out of the Southern District, and it's called Hirsch versus Jupiter Golf Club. It's 232 Federal Supplement 3D1243. And this case brings us back to general principles of contract interpretation. We talk about the court's duty is to interpret the contract in such a manner to, I guess, capture the party's intent. You know, what's important? What do the parties intend to bargain for? And it says, in considering and interpreting what the parties intended to bargain for, you can look at evidence, extrinsic evidence outside the record, to show not what was done before the contract was entered into, but how the parties performed under the contracts. You know, what was their course of performance? How does that show their belief as to what the coverage under this particular case was?
Is that a Florida case?
So that would be, that's a Southern District case.
Florida law?
Yes, and so they rely on a Florida Supreme Court case, and that case is the Black Hawk Heating and Plumbing, and that's 302 Southern 2nd 404. And the court says, courts are allowed to look at the party's conduct in performing their contract to resolve the absence of a provision on that. And it says, and the parties, by their own conduct, placed a construction upon it which is reasonable. Such construction will be adopted by the court upon the principle that it is duty of the court to give effect to the intention of the parties when it is not wholly at variance with the correct legal interpretation of the terms of the contract. And the Hirsch court goes on to say, the parole evidence rule precludes admission of a prior or contemporaneous evidence with the formation of the contract, but course of performance is not parole, doesn't violate the parole evidence rule because it comes later. It shows the intent. So let's look at what the...
How does that, just so I'm clear, how does that square up with the Florida Supreme Court's answer to our certified question in the Washington National case, where they seem to say, yeah, look, we've got district courts of appeals that are considering extrinsic evidence to construe insurance contracts, and that's wrong, because what you're supposed to do, if the thing is ambiguous, is construe it in favor of the insured.
You know, I went and I looked at those latent and patent defect cases, and I tried to go through a number of...
Well, I'm not even sure. I guess before we get there, I'm happy for you to get to latent and patent, but again, maybe this is my own confusion, but... I guess I'm taking what the court says in Washington National to say, when there is an ambiguity, full stop, what do you do? Contra preferentum says you construe it in favor of the insured.
Yeah, I think that what they were saying is not what, notwithstanding what is happening in the lower court in this case, considering extrinsic evidence, let's not lose sight of the principle that ambiguities are construed against the drafter. I don't think that that is exclusive to considering any other evidence. I think you can still consider other evidence. And the Florida Supreme Court, in the case that I referenced at the Hirsch case cites, says it is entirely appropriate to consider course of conduct evidence. So in this case, that course of conduct evidence is the fact that, we have all the emails showing that they didn't want windstorm coverage. Let's, after the Matthew claim, they filed their Matthew claim in October of 26. It was denied in late October of 26. Written reasons were no windstorm coverage. They had a renewal meeting with the agent that came up for the Irma policy in January, just a couple months later. At no point during that meeting did they say, we want named windstorm coverage. So I think that course of conduct evidence is important here, and it's not violative of the parole evidence rule.
What does the decision tree look like for a court interpreting an insurance policy? If the court looks at the policy and says, I conclude that this is ambiguous, at that point it seems to me there are two possible moves. One is, contra preferentum says I've got to give the benefit of the doubt to the insured. The other is, well, I guess I can consider extrinsic evidence, at least to the extent that it bears on course of conduct. Is it one or the other, or do you think it's kind of both? I don't really understand what the what a court confronting that fork in the road is supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that there's a logical tree, you know, that we would like to have and see every single court follow. I think if you look at the cases, you're going to find some that are all over the map.
The right answer?
Sure. So in looking over this and preparing for today, I think that, yes, I'm not going to disagree and stand here and say that you're not supposed to interpret the contract if it's ambiguous against my client. I still think that you are allowed to consider other forms of evidence that might shed light to get you to that truth, to get you to the just and correct answer.
So I guess what you're saying then is that the two moves can operate simultaneously. You can construe a contract against the drafter or in favor of the insured, while at the same time sort of peeking at the other extrinsic evidence to get a sense for like what the parties really meant.
I think so. So when you're construing something, if you find it to be ambiguous, the goal again, I think, is to get at what the party's intent was. So I think these, the parole evidence rule, these other devices, I think these are devices a court can use, and we've sort of developed some rules and some structure about where the courts can borrow from this and borrow from this and deviate from the written document. But I think at the end of the day, what is correct? We need to find what the party's intended to do. What does the evidence show the party's intended to do?
So here's the question that I have. It seems like we've got a couple new doctrines that have been under discussion, right? And maybe the patent-laden doctrine would favor your friends on the other side. And maybe the doctrine from Hirsch that you've talked about would favor the position that you're taking. But what do we do with the fact that the district court didn't consider, that I can tell, either of those doctrines? Have both of the parties forfeited? Are we limited to kind of the decision tree that the district court used in the absence of either party pointing out any error in that decision tree and just evaluating that decision kind of for what it is on its own terms?
Well, Your Honor, that decision favors me. So to the extent
they've argued that it's, wrong for reasons besides the ones that we've talked about. So I don't know that necessarily favors one party or the other, but have you both essentially forfeited these other arguments, or should we still consider them for some reason?
Well, Your Honor, you have this de novo, so I don't think that it's been forfeited if that's something that the lower court didn't review. Again, we think that Marcusano was a correct way for the lower court to follow to get to their rationale, regardless of any ambiguities, regardless of the patent of latent defect. So there is a basis there. I would like to address, because we talked about the merger clause and policy, and I did look at that law as well. Aspen's policy says, and it changes is the subtitle, and it says, this policy contains all the agreements between you and us concerning the insurance afforded. It goes on, the first name insured shown in the declarations is authorized to make changes, blah, blah, blah. So it basically just says under what terms changes can be made is our position. Now, the case on the, I have a case called Duval that I found that discusses the merger clause. And that's Duval Motors versus Rogers, and that's 73 Southern 3rd, 261. And the court, this is a Florida First Circuit case, and they say the purpose of a merger clause is to affirm the party's intent to have the parole evidence rule applied to their contracts. And when you look at the parole evidence clauses, the merger clauses you find in some of these contracts and the cases you pull, there is a statement that the agreement supersedes all informal understandings and oral agreements related to the contract. That's what the Duval case says. But you could pull some of the other cases that the court had in the order to us. And there is language in those contracts that say, this provision or all the agreements are superseded by this agreement. We don't have that supersession language in the Aspen contract. So I would argue that is not an integration clause. To what extent that would preclude the application of the parole evidence rule. I'm not sure, but I don't think we need to get there, because I think it's appropriate for you to consider the cases showing conduct of the parties and intent after the fact. It looks like my time is up, so unless you have any other questions, thank you very much.
I just want to briefly respond to a few things and then kind of lay out the decision tree there. At least that's my plan, but obviously happy to answer questions instead. So first, as you heard, there was no support, no justification given to this court how the policy possibly excluded coverage. The only thing you were pointed to was something outside the policy, like emails or renewal documents, applications. I just want to very quickly read this court's decision, King versus Allstate from this court, and it which explained it's Hornbook insurance law that a binder merges into a subsequently issued insurance policy. That's the part that they rely on. And in case of a conflict or ambiguity, the policy controls. In addition to that, the State Farm versus Mallard case we cite as well, which also says if there's conflict between the application and the policy, the one that provides greater coverage is the one that controls. That's exactly what we set forth in our motion in response to their summary judgment and our summary judgment. So they have no support offered to this court that their policy excludes coverage. The only thing they presented is extrinsic evidence where the case law is abundantly clear that the policy controls over that. So that is just to respond to their points. And in terms of the decision tree, and we did it in our motions, we tried to encourage the district court to follow this. But if you look at it, so if you go with the 2016 policy, the first thing you do is look at the policy. Does it provide coverage? And as I've explained, that policy does have some ambiguities on the face of the policy. Those ambiguities exist because on the declaration page, it has a three-page words indicating that there is coverage for wind, but exclusion for named windstorms provides no definition. Later in the policy, clearly provides coverage for several aspects of the damage. So it's ambiguous, and what we propose to the district court to follow is the correct thing is because it's ambiguous, it should be construed in favor of the insured.
That's your response to his response to my question, that maybe sort of the principle of contra proferentum and sort of consideration, the Hirsch principle, consideration of extrinsic evidence to show course of conduct, they can sort of operate simultaneously.
Yes, so to get there, they would have had to give you an explanation like the questions did where you could get there. And before you could get there, first there would have to be a latent ambiguity, which none has been presented. The ambiguity exists on the face of the policy. And second, when you look at the cases that have been cited by this court on what constitutes a latent ambiguity and what extrinsic evidence could be considered, it is extremely limited. If you look at this court's decision, Johnson Enterprises versus FPL, it's for something very small, like you can look beyond the policy to see who are actually parties to the contract. And that explained, that's because you're not really rewriting it. You're just looking, hey, who signed that application? Are they indeed party to the contract? You can do a consider that type of extrinsic evidence. So they haven't even proffered a latent ambiguity, and they haven't given you a scenario where that would ever be proper. So that's kind of the third part. And then on the 2017 policy, the decision tree, easy there, as I think it's beyond dispute. Now you look at the policy itself, it provides coverage. There's no ambiguity to it. It clearly provides coverage. They don't proffer anything to dispute that. So you never even get to where you would even possibly consider whether you would go beyond that. And if you did, as I indicated before, if you did consider, which would be improper, whether you go beyond that, only thing they point you to is the insurance application and some emails. And Florida law is beyond clear that if those contradict each other, the policy controls.
So let's say that we do think that the latent patent distinction matters. I'm not necessarily saying that's what any of us thinks, even me. But let's say that we did. Would your client have forfeited that argument by not discussing it in those terms?
No, we would not, because our position is that the what you do is just a general. I answered those questions because they were proffered a few days ago. Our position is you don't need to get into that because the Florida law has already decided on that as it relates to insurance contracts. based on, best example is the 11th Circuit. This court submitted that question to the Florida Supreme Court. In the insurance contract, it's different. It's a higher standard. And because
wasn't
of that,
wasn't that case about an insurance contract, though?
It was. And in that case, they the Florida Supreme Court, if I may, and it talked in just a quick quote of it, district court decisions that allowed extrinsic evidence in an attempt to explain, clarify, or resolve an ambiguity in an insurance contract do not alter this court's established precedents that ambiguous contracts of insurance are to be construed against the insurer as the drafter of the policy. So that you don't even need to go. That's why our argument is you don't even go down that road. There's clearly an ambiguity as to one of the policy. This is an insurance policy, not just a general contract. And because it's an insurance contract, it's already the law's already established. You are to construe that in favor of the insured in that contract.
Although one more thing, that decision was a plurality, right?
I did see a note to that, but there's if you go through my initial brief, I cited several other Florida Supreme Court cases with that exact same premise.
Thank you.
So I would rely on those. Those are all the questions I have. I would ask that the summary judgment be reversed for further proceedings. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
We'll be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.